Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of Ayers LA, and it feels good to be back. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on Ayers LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is by Crystal Herb, Wall Street's top coffee tasters are looking for new recruits. Then we'll follow that up with an article by Barton Swain, America Loses Its Will to Work. Nathan Schatz wrote, Recovering from Generation Z Over-Sanitized World. And then we have one by Faith Bottom, In Defense of the McDonald's Cheeseburger. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one. Wall Street's top coffee tasters are looking for new recruits. The people who gather in the small room on the 8th floor of the New York Stock Exchange look like a group of middle-aged caffeine addicts. They sit around what resembles a school science lab, sniffing coffee beans and slurping coffee so aggressively that there's loud music playing to drown them out. But these aren't junkies with bad manners. They're part of an elite team of graders who help keep the commodities market running. Their ratings help set United States future market prices for Arabica and in turn, the global coffee industry. And they're arguably never been more valuable. That's because the flow of the young talent that keeps the grading system running is slowing to a drip. For one thing, young people are opting to work at private equity firms, high-frequency trading desks, and other glitzier jobs where coffee serves as fuel, not product. And even among high-earning commodity traders, coffee is seen as less glamorous than oil and natural gas. But perhaps the biggest impediment is that the test to become a grader is not getting any easier. The four-day exam, given roughly once every 5 years, including recently, has a razor-thin pass rate. John DeMuria, chief executive of coffee supply chain company Coastal Commodities and a grader of 35 years, said he failed the first time he tried. It's not like the CPA exam, he said. Once you fail, you have to go back and start over. If you pass certain parts, it does not count the second go-round. DeMuria is in good company. Only about 5 to 8% of test takers will typically pass each time the test is administered, according to Stacy Moeller, who runs the grading room as Senior Commodities Operation Analyst or New York Stock Exchange Parent Intercontinental Exchange, or ICE. The pass rate for California's notoriously difficult bar exam that was given in February 2025 was 64%. It's a very tough test, said Terrence Sullivan, who has been a coffee grader for 41 years. His brother is a grader, and his son will be taking the next exam. Many of the people in ICE's grading room are in their 50s or older, says DeMuria. Some are retirees, while others, after clocking in at around 6:30 a.m. Eastern time to grade coffee, will head to their full-time jobs, often in the coffee industry. The current roster of 38 graders sit around spinning tables that are ringed with cups of coffee and trays of beans. Armed with spoons, they test the samples in a rapid-fire process of slurping and spitting into metal sinks they call spittoons. Tasting the coffee properly requires slurping it with gusto, hence the music to mask the sounds of dozens of people slurping and spitting. Those wanting to be a part of the clutch must first prove their abilities in a three-stage test. The first part is a written portion where prospective graders are tested on ICE's rules and regulations regarding coffee grading. In the second portion, which is more than 3 hours long, they are tested on their ability to grade the coffee based on factors such as smell and color. If they fail at any stage, they must start from the beginning to retake it. If they pass those portions, they are brought back to the grading room, sometimes months later, for the final cupping exam. Smelling, tasting, and spitting coffee in front of proctors to determine whether there are defects. The recent test kicked off this past Monday. Getting selected requires a strong application, including references and at least 5 years of experience working in the industry. Working at a trading desk, as a grader at a coffee company, or at a warehouse counts. Being a barista absolutely does not, says Moeller. Despite the worries, there is an unusually high number of candidates this year due to buildup from the pandemic. There were only about 20 candidates the last time the test was administered. Matt Ryan, ICE's Senior Director of Global Soft Commodities, said the swell of interest has him hopeful that there could soon be a much-needed group of young talent headed to the grading room. It's exciting to see that turnover happen, said Ryan. For a while in the business, I was feeling young in my 50s. And now America loses its will to work. In democratic peoples, where there is no hereditary wealth, everyone works to live, or has worked, or was born of people who work. The idea of work as a necessary, natural, and honest condition of humanity is therefore offered to the human mind on every side. Thus wrote Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America about the reverence with which this country's citizens in the 1830s regarded remunerative labor. The great French writer compared aristocratic society, among whose elite work was regarded as a thing to be done for honor, but not money, with the nascent bourgeois society of America, in which gainful employment was an unavoidable part of life. Half a century ago, the average college-educated American would have endorsed Tocqueville's remark and marveled that anyone would think otherwise. In the 2020s, many Americans evidence a deep confusion about the nature and purpose of work. The weakening of America's Protestant work ethic, to use a contested but irreplaceable phrase, is a complicated story, but you could trace its beginnings to the 1960s. No one has chronicled that story more incisively than Nicholas Eberstadt of the American Enterprise Institute. Back in November, Mr. Eberstadt published America's Human Arithmetic, a collection of essays mainly on the subject of labor. The book includes a 2014 address about Lyndon B. Johnson's War on Poverty, that assortment of programs begun in the mid-1960s, Head Start, Medicaid, expanded food stamps, and many others. Did the war bring victory? On the one hand, today's poor live vastly more prosperous lives by any material measure than the poor of the 1960s. Talk of citizens living over or under a poverty line is meaningless, Mr. Eberstadt showed. The de facto line having risen so dramatically upward, a fact that has little to do with government transfer payments and almost everything to do with rapid economic growth in the post-war period. On the other hand, anti-poverty programs have left more or less the same proportion of the citizenry dependent on welfare and disinclined to join the workforce. So private sector growth has made today's poor rich by comparison with their forerunners two generations ago, even if government anti-poverty measures have ensured that today's poor, however well off by comparison, remain dependent and resistant to upward mobility. The war on poverty has not only failed, it has weakened virtues its originators took for granted. Three decades after the war on poverty began, congressional Republicans tabbed and a Democratic president signed the most sweeping reform yet made to America's welfare state. The Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996 conditioned the most important forms of direct welfare payments on employment or the search for employment. Opponents predicted disaster. New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, formerly a critic of America's welfare state, predicted that his colleagues who voted for the bill would take this disgrace to their graves. In fact, the reform succeeded. It moved millions off welfare rolls and into the labor market. The law mainly reformed aid to families with dependent children, which it renamed Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. But expansions and liberalizations of other safety net programs in succeeding years have negated the gains made by the 1996 law. Is a similar reform possible in 2026? Not a chance. The culture has radically changed. In the mid-1990s, politicians and commentators could still speak of America's work ethic without apology. In the 2020s, America's cognoscente constantly suggests something baneful in the bourgeois idea that gainful toil is virtuous. Movies romanticizing manipulated workers and vilifying rapacious corporate executives, intellectuals contending that the 5-day, 40-hour work week abuses wage laborers. Academics suggesting terms like work ethic are racist. Journalists ready to portray every worker-management relationship as exploitative. A steady stream of freshly published books crosses my desk in which authors insist that the American workplace jades employees and managers alike. Recall also the COVID-era glorification of quiet quitting, in which employees simply stopped doing the jobs they were contracted to do, and the scores of think pieces claiming that Americans' work-life balance is less than optimal. Note the tacit premise that work is opposed to life. Evidence abounds that many Americans no longer consider gainful work a natural and necessary part of life. The sudden explosion of online sports betting bespeaks a nation of young men looking for ways to pocket cash for no work. The Supreme Court's 2018 decision in Murphy versus the NCAA struck down a federal prohibition from 1992. By the time of that ruling, the stigma attaching to sports betting had all but disappeared, and widespread legalization seemed destined one way or another. Pandemic-era measures that kept able-bodied men in their homes, bored and looking for ways to pocket a few bucks, enhanced the attractiveness of wagering on games. Americans bet $5 billion on sports in 2018. In 2024, they bet $150 billion. The sports betting phenomenon reveals, if nothing else, the loss of any notion that income should bear some relation to a product or service rendered. The bettor produces no product or service for his winnings. Indeed, that is the draw, money for nothing, or nothing that benefits anyone but the bettor. Such an ethic bothered previous generations. It bothers ours much less. Ponder also the sudden ubiquity of advertisements for personal injury law firms that promise to get their client ample reward for damages. All over the country, one encounters them on television, radio, and billboards, with phone numbers leading to call centers that weed out weak claims. Have so many people really suffered bodily injury? An unknowing visitor to the United States in 2026 might be forgiven for wondering why more Americans are not hobbling around in leg casts and wearing neck braces. Some personal injury suits are right and just, yet any moderately observant person can see that the industry, if that's the right term for it, has tapped into a massive amount of Americans no longer ashamed to avoid work and rake in unearned cash. We've known for years about the slow flight of working age men from gainful employment. Mr. Eberstadt's Men Without Work, done in 2016, documents in painful detail the moral and psychological cost of men leaving the labor force since the mid-1960s. New and frightening is the phenomenon of disconnection among the young, both male and female. About one in seven Americans 18 to 24, according to a recent RAND study, are neither looking for work or liking it. Many young people support a universal basic income, a government payment to every American, regardless of income or employment status. Back in 1996, 30 Democrats in the House and 25 in the Senate voted to reform welfare laws, and a Democratic president signed the bill. Today, approximately zero Democrats exhibit any interest in changing to welfare programs that do not involve spending more on them. Since the death of George Floyd and attendant protests, moreover, the nation's cultural arbiters decided not to question the premises of the Great Society and War on Poverty, and instead to double down on welfare state fundamentalism. If Republicans wish to do anything about America's declining work ethic, they will have to do it alone. The public knows there's a problem. Stories about the theft of billions of dollars from Medicaid and other programs in Minnesota have revived the idea that welfare programs dole out money to undeserving recipients and need reform. The fraud in Minnesota, perpetrated mostly by members of the state's Somali population, is stupendous in its scope and cost. So much so that the center-left press, including the New York Times, felt obliged to cover the story. But similar stories of welfare fraud have emerged in Michigan, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere, all covered by local media. Millions of ordinary Americans, moreover, saw the bogus ways in which large parts of the public sector used the 2020-2021 pandemic as an excuse not to work. They also see the major disincentives to productivity. The exploding use of marijuana, thanks to the federal government's refusal to enforce its ban, the ease with which undeserving applicants may receive benefits from programs like women, infants, and children, among many others, and the channeling of ambitious and industrious college graduates into jobs that create no useful product or service, academic instructors in arcane subjects, sustainability advisors, diversity coordinators, develop and communication managers for activist organizations, and on and on. The rebuilding of America's work ethic is a politically saleable theme ready for use by any candidate brave enough to talk about a subject requiring a few sentences of a nuanced explanation. But most Republicans avoid the subject or address it when they must obnoxiously. Last summer, when GOP lawmakers passed a budget bill that imposed modest work requirements on able-bodied recipients of Medicaid payments, they defended the provision in one of two ways, either by misleadingly claiming that illegal aliens' use of Medicaid dollars justified the reform, or by referring sardonically to able-bodied men in their parents' basement playing video games or some such phrase. America's work ethic deficit goes far beyond illegal migrants who know they risk deportation if they get caught taking benefits and dudes living with their parents. It's true that any suggestion of reforming a federal welfare program to encourage its recipients to achieve greater financial independence will invite accusations of heartlessness, cruelty, and racism. That's politics. A genuine concern for lives distorted by unreformed welfare programs can make those accusations sound empty. Two further circumstances complicate a coherent GOP message on work and welfare. First, a small but influential part of the party rejects the conservative insight that public handouts tend to distort incentives to work. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, the most vocal exponent of this viewpoint, last year fulminated at the overwhelming majority of his fellow Republican lawmakers who voted for a modest stiffening of Medicaid eligibility rules. He calls Medicaid working class social insurance and cheers its expansion. Aligned with Mr. Hawley are Vice President J.D. Vance and an influential group of socially right-wing but state-friendly conservatives. Second, the Trump administration has made its chief policy objective the expulsion of illegal aliens. The president's political advisors show every sign of making that effort, for all its problems in execution, the central Republican message in this year's midterm elections. The great majority of Americans support the effort to deport illegal immigrants who have committed crimes other than crossing the border unlawfully, and probably a majority assents in the abstract to the defensibility of deporting all illegal aliens regardless of criminal record. But in rounding up law-abiding migrant workers, the administration has found itself targeting men looking for work in Home Depot parking lots. Men who want to engage in gainful labor and who, whatever zealous Republicans might say in election year, don't draw welfare checks. Hispanics, overwhelmingly the object of zealous immigration enforcement, consistently outperform all other groups in labor force participation rates. The administration's highest priority, to put the point bluntly, appeared to be to deport guys who hang drywall, install shingles, and generally contribute to economic growth. None of this need stop GOP office holders and seekers from making the case for the Protestant work ethic in 2026 and beyond. Since the pandemic, American society has seemed to turn away from its presuppositional faith in remunerative labor. Our belief in work, as in Tocqueville's words, a necessary, natural, and honest condition of humanity, is no longer a tacit assumption, but a disputed viewpoint. Elected leaders cannot solve that problem by passing reforms to welfare laws, but they can force the public to consider the subject. That the public will reward them for it is not certain, but a proud nation generally likes to be reminded of its old virtues. And now we have Nathan Schatz recovering from Generation Z's over-sanitized world. The night I almost died, my mother drove through a raging blizzard and did not say a word. We'd already been to one hospital where they'd drawn blood, looked at the results, and told us to go home. She sat in the parking lot for a long moment, the engine idling. Then she put the car in drive. I was 8 years old. My right arm had woken me up a few hours earlier, burning and swollen past the point where it even looked like an arm. At the second hospital, a surgeon walked in, took one look at me, and stopped with that stillness that comes before hard news. He turned to my mother and said, slowly, "We are taking him to the operating room. Necrotizing fasciitis, flesh-eating bacteria. Mortality rate above 50%. They drew a line on my arm with a marker to track the infection's progress. By the time they prepped me for surgery, it had already crossed it. I emerged from surgery 4.5 hours later with 72 stitches. The next morning, a parade of residents filled my room because word had spread. Most of them would never see a case like this again. My mother's relief was instant, but only years later would I learn that the antibiotics that saved my life had also gutted something else, a microbial ecosystem I'd been building since birth. The wrong things moved in, they do not leave easily. I spent years tired and inflamed, but no one connected the dots. It took me a long time to recover, even longer to understand that my story was not unique. My parents' and grandparents' generations ran barefoot outside, eating and exposing themselves to things that transformed their microbiomes, the trillions of organisms living in and on their bodies that quietly kept them healthy. My generation got a much more sanitized version of that childhood. We ate more foods engineered for shelf life and were fed antibiotics without fully understanding the potential downsides. The products on our bathroom shelves, marketed as clean, stripped away essential bacteria. The fallout from these and other environmental factors has been dire. According to data collected by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, since the late 1990s, allergy rates in kids have increased 70%. Chronic inflammation that used to be rare in young people is also on the rise. People say that Generation Z has become nihilistic, that in the face of our chronic problems, we've given up. Part of the issue is that our over-sanitized world has not fully prepared us to deal with messiness, which can leave us feeling overwhelmed. Others of us have decided to stop complaining and start looking for solutions. I went to college to study molecular biology because I needed to understand what had happened to me. Through my research into ocular disease and autophagy, a theme emerged of normally robust human systems quietly breaking down. My skin never got the memo that it had survived the devastating attack. I developed persistent acne throughout high school and college, the kind that does not respond to anything and nobody can explain. I tried everything. At the same time, I sensed a low hum of defeatism across campus. Why build anything? It felt like my classmates were reaching for whatever quick fix was nearest, for their anxiety, their skin, their sense of purpose, without asking what was really going on beneath the surface. It reminded me of my ordeal as a kid, the body screaming that something was wrong and nobody grasping the root cause. So I got a small grant, bought a swab kit, and spent a semester knocking on doors to ask classmates if I could sample the bacteria on their faces. For my peers battling acne, eczema, or chronic sensitivity, most of the remedies did not seem to work. I wanted to know what was living on us before we stripped anything else off. The results were not comforting. When I sequenced the skin microbiomes of over 150 students, I found exactly what the emerging literature had begun to warn about. Bacterial ecosystems stripped of their diversity, reduced to a fraction of what published data describes as healthy. The science that hinted at a generational decline in skin microbiome health. My data seemed to confirm it. After the surgery that saved my life, I'd been so jacked up on morphine that I'd wanted to see what my bones look like. I will never forget the uncanny feeling of staring inside my own arm. I'm now 23, and I've launched a company to continue my research, hoping to help my generation heal its microbiome. And when I think back to the time I stared into the abyss and lived long enough to understand what it meant, I know this: we cannot become a generation that looks away. And we do have one more by Faith Bottom, in defense of the McDonald's cheeseburger. Tender, juicy, all beef hamburgers. Bring the family tonight. So read the McDonald's ad from 1957. We have sold over 50 million. By 1965, the ads were proclaiming billions and billions served. McDonald's has been the object of a social media derision since a February 3rd video of its CEO nibbling daintily at the chain's latest offering, the multi-layer Big Arch. In an interview with the Journal, he jokingly blamed his mother for teaching him not to talk with his mouth full. But here's the hard-to-digest gastronomical fact. A McDonald's cheeseburger is a better deal today than it was in 1948. There's a reason those billions and billions of burgers were sold, which is simply that a McDonald's burger is one of the best caloric bargains on the planet. A cheeseburger in 1948 cost 19 cents, while the federal minimum wage was 40 cents an hour. Today, the corporation reports the price of a cheeseburger at around $3.89, depending on region. And McDonald's workers average $12 to $14 an hour, with California's minimum wage for fast food workers at $20 an hour. Even with the lower average wage, that's 3.1 cheeseburgers an hour today, as opposed to 2.1 in 1948. Food snobs would be horrified, but there are serious chefs who appreciate McDonald's offerings. Marco Pierre White, the youngest chef to earn 3 Michelin stars and the man who arguably defined current fine dining, made headlines back in 2007 after he praised McDonald's affordability, saying that pound for pound, it offered better food than a lot of restaurants. Fran Adrià, the Spanish chef whose restaurant was named the world's best for 5 years, said in a 2008 interview that he was looking forward to going back to McDonald's and that, "I don't think people should come and say McDonald's is not good. What is the alternative for the same price?" They're right. McDonald's is still cheap if you know what to get. Say what you will about McDonald's specialty concoctions, the lamb, hare and sea burger, a Big Mac McChicken and filet of fish combined, chicken McGriddle, fried chicken between maple syrup infused pancake buns, or the soon to be released Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, caffeine added to soda, or the sticker shock of a $5 milkshake, or the Big Arch, which can set you back as much as $12.99. The humble cheeseburger has stood the test of time. In my home state of South Dakota, there is a 9-foot bronze and granite statue of a cheeseburger inscribed with "hot and deliciously juicy" in Latin. According to a McDonald's representative, the monument was erected back in 2020, which was the 50th anniversary of the Quarter Pounder, because Rapid City was selected for having the most Quarter Pounder with cheese fans per capita. Maybe this is why I've always had a fondness for the fast food chain and its cheeseburger. It's both delicious and a pretty good bang for your buck. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.